23. Mindsight. I cannot fight alone. In those four words, he tells me everything. I am lost for words of my own. The implication, the intent, is shocking. It was what I hoped and wanted to hear, but what it signifies petrifies me. It means his assessment matches mine. This is the end. We stand upon a precipice so sheer that only actions of true last resort are possible. A war that forces him to fight is a war that no one should have begun. His words resound inside my skull. All I can think is that from this point on, it will be bloody and costly and messy. He will have a plan already, because he always has a plan, and he will take me through it soon enough and ask for my advice and wisdom. But whatever form it takes, it will be grueling and difficult, even for him, each step back from the brink as hard as the next. Of course you can't, I say. Of course you can't fight alone. I turn aside and begin preparations at once. I must summon those who need to be part of this. Once they are alerted and on their way to join us, he can lay out his strategy for me. He needs instruments to brandish torches and keep the darkness at bay as it comes at him from every angle. Who still lives that he can place such trust in? My mind sight spreads wide across all that remains visible. I look for his sons. I look for our last allies. Let them be revealed. There. The first, closest to us, yet likewise far away, far beneath the throne in the looping neverness of the webway. His name is Vulcan. I would say he is singular, though each of my lord's sons is singular in his own fashion. Upon Vulcan, my master bestowed a special part of himself. Vulcan is the only one of the Primarch's sons who inherited his father's Eve eternal nature. My master is eternal, and so is Vulcan. It is a trait, in fact, they share with me. Thus, Vulcan lives, and Vulcan dies, and Vulcan lives again. To Vulcan, my master entrusted enduring continuity, the courage to keep the flame alive. Vulcan is Athanasi embodied. Vulcan has not failed his father, not ever, and it has cost him too many lives and deaths already. I see him deep in the webway, hammer in hand, trudging homeward to take his place at the gate beneath the throne. Tears spring to my eyes at the mindsight of him. He is but a charred skeleton, a burned écorche in an anatomist's dissecting lab, crusted ribbons of flesh broiled to his cracked bones, refusing to die, trying to heal. He stumbles. His newborn heart, misshapen, has foundered and burst. He falls dead, and then lives. Such is the curse gifted to him. He lives and slowly hauls his bones upright once more, clawing at the haft of his scorched hammer for support. He stands. He sways. He starts to walk again. Vulcan has just killed Magnus, the second greatest of his father's failures, the greatest of his disappointments. Because of what Magnus is now, that death won't last. The Lord of Prospero can't really die. But Vulcan has vanquished him and banished his deathless corpse into the outer darkness. I do not know how many times Vulcan died performing that deed, or how many times he has died on the long walk back from it, starting and restarting as he struggles to fully live again. Vulcan has killed Magnus, but still the warp screams at his heels, and the screech of pursuing demons echoes down the hollow psychoplastic pathways of the webway behind him. I reach to him and whisper gently into his still renewing mind. I tell him that we need him here. I need him to stand and guard the throne and bar the webway door. He must hold it while his father is gone. He does not answer. He cannot. He has no lips nor tongue, no throat, barely even an embryonic sentience. But I feel his assent. Vulcan will prevail. He will not fail us, for he is eternal, just as we made him to be. He is the quintessence of infinite patience. I watch him a moment longer, the halting skeleton, dragging itself back from innumerable graves, meat and sinew slowly knitting on its bones, blood welling forth, as from some sacred spring, to plump the neoblastic veins and capillaries still sprouting like vines across his reassembling frame, the hammer dragging heavy on the ground behind him. He walks, relentlessly, half dead, out of the furnace, out of the nocturnal veil to serve the throne. He walks back from death, one step at a time, as his father prepares to walk towards what will probably be his. Who else? I look again. My mind extends across this chamber that others call the throne room, upwards to the cloth of gold baldachin suspended above the throne, a vast canopy embroidered with the contradictory yet intertwined principles of Concordia and Discordia that frames the electric blue aura of my great lord's light. Outwards from the throne's massive plinth, carved from the psychoreactive material known on the craft worlds as wraithbone, and inset with cycurium and dark glass panels, tourmaline and aerolithic moldavite, past silent Azkaral and Kaikaltus at their posts, past the gleaming ranks of the Heteron companies at attention beyond them, out like a rushing tide across the lustrous floor of sectile marble and auslite, across the susurrating banks of stasis generators, archaeotech regulators and psychanic amplifiers that surround and feed the throne, prophylactic mechanisms brought here in haste and urgently set to work when the folly of Magnus cracked the harmonized serenity of this aditum. Past the diligent conclaves of the ad nectar concilium in their cowls and chasubles, standing amid the fat snakes and intestinal loops of power cables, ministering to the operation of these murmuring devices. Then further out, along the frightful height and breadth of the cyclopean nave itself, a canyon turned upside down, between the soaring oromite columns rising like the trunks of mature sequoiadendron giganteum, the solomonic pillars of twisted bronze, the acanthus-headed colonnettes, the gargantuan scissor arches. Beneath the shining, ornate electro-flambeaux strung like stalactite pendants from the dizzying ceiling, and between the lumen orbs that float like infant suns, on, past echelons of burnished automata maintaining talismanic psychosystems, past empty scarlet cushion stalls, where once the High Lords of the Council gathered, and the void manic worthies of the Navis Nobility awaited audience. Past the golden pulpits of the cataleptic astropaths, adrift in algalagnic fugues, around the clattering dream dynamos and stegosaurian honorio looms, past the hypnostatic augury kilns, breathing steam and dripping myrrh, and the affirmatrix prognometers, leaking synthetic plasma, and exhaling the smell of industrially recovered nightmares, past the scriptorums of the noctuaries, past brass reliquaries and vidradur grails, past mother-of-pearl loggia, where bewitched diviners and incanting prognostipractors sift and read the ribbon tapes of transcribed glossolalia, spilled from the chattering indifference engines, searching for morsels of meaning. Past prophesiers swinging thuribles and technoseers wheeling scrim-shandered ferretries. Past mendicants in penance at their kneeling desks and anchorites bearing electro-generative monstrances. On through the sound of melismatic antiphon and canticle welling from the mouthless choirs in chantry niches, screened by lace pattern iconostases, so they cannot catch sight of him and forget the words. Past regiments of catechumen observants, seeking expiation and brimming with Eucharistic ardour. Along the walls of porphyry and mica mosaic, frescoes of death's head putti and cackling ephebes that conceal hidden figures of alchemy. Past engraved genealogies, and past the blazoned armorial hatchments of the 20 legions, all but 8 now shrouded in amaranthine drapes of mourning. Past the iron tabernacles of the chimerical brethrendi, composing, as rapidly and ceaselessly as they can, via feverish automatic writing, new variations of the material truth in a frantic effort to mediate and divert the impending bow wave of fate. Past flocks of scurrying serfs and deferential abhumans, all blindfolded, so they can remain present and sane at the same time, all rushing to deliver reports that no longer matter. Past Zagreus Cain, the fabricator in exile, with his coterie of adepts, weeping for the decimation of his battle engines and plotting the deployment of the few that remain. Past acres of empty marble floor, where one day we will have to place tombs. Past the great banners of liberty and victory that hang like waterfalls from the high walls every step of the nave 6 kilometer length. Beneath the vaulted gloom of the ceiling, wrought of Peruvian gold and trompe l'oeil and crystal mined on Enceladus, a ceiling 1 kilometer high. Past the silent, waiting companies of the refulgent custodes pylorus, who make their motionless vigil at the door, whispering their ever-mantra of "by his will alone" to the ceramite and adamantine door itself, the silver door, the innermost gate of eternity. And out. It's just a room. I go beyond. Beyond, my urgent mind-sight stretches. Through the eternal door, beyond the secular humanist cathedral of his throne room, into the alabaster halls outside, to the acheronic avenues of approach, the measureless rock-crete tunnels that thread the inner sanctum, the radiant bridges spanning infinite cavern gulfs, in the aphotic depths of which crushed grave cities lay untouched. I do not linger. My mind floods out through the buried halls of the final fortress, through each of the great seals, along fusion board mass passageways where armies once marched to crave benediction, and Titan engines strode 10 abreast to approach him like supplicants and kneel like men at his feet. There. 2 more. 2 more coming through the lambent sodium glare. Rogel Dawn, the stalwart Praetorian, and beloved Sanguinius. I have no need to summon either of them, for they are already hurrying to us, side by side, flanked by the greatest of their lieutenants, imperial fists and blood angels, a delegation of Astartes. They are coming to him as a deputation, I think. They have done all they can, beyond all that could have been asked. But the clocks run out. They are coming to tell him it is time. They are coming to tell him, demand of him, that he rise up with them at this second before midnight. And if he won't, they are coming to remove him and escort him to safety. He has refused this option since the siege began. It is not pride. It is not a refusal to acknowledge the threat. It is simply that there is no safety. There is nowhere to go in the entire span of the galaxy where he would be safe from what is approaching. Rogel, perhaps his truest son, the exemplar of unwavering loyalty. I see his emptiness. He is undone, his body aching and exhausted, his armor battered by combat during the frenetic retreat from Bab Bastion, his mind spent. That exhaustion is a terrible thing to feel. Rogel, one of the finest strategists in history, oversaw this defense. He orchestrated the fortification of our stronghold, and his tactics, brilliant, ambitious, mercurial, ran the game, the greatest game of regicide ever played. I want to embrace him and praise him for his labor. He has excelled and sustained his play beat by beat by means of engineered planning, shrewd anticipation and reflexive improvisation through every harrowing turn of fortune. But his mind is empty. There is no more game. There are no more moves to make. I sense the vacuum in him, his weary mind surprised to find itself spinning free and wild, with nothing left to process or decide. The feeling is alien to him, and toxic. He has never not known what to do. He has never not known what is coming next. He hopes his father does. He is coming to beg his father to tell him. And Sanguinius. His physical wounds are greater, though he hides them from others behind the aura of his being. He cannot hide them from me. Beneath his projected radiance, I can see the damage to his armor and his body, the open wounds, the tattered and scorched feathers of his wings. Now he is back inside the sanctum. The aegis of his father's protective spirit is healing him, faster than any mortal could ever heal. But it is not enough. He may never be whole again. He will bear some of these crippling injuries for the remainder of his life. He tries to walk tall. He hopes his sons will not see the spots of blood he leaves behind him on the hallway floors. He has just conquered both Angron, the strongest and most hate-filled of our foes, and Karbanda, the demon bane of the Ninth. But that incomparable pair of deeds has cost him woefully. And unlike Vulcan, Sanguinius has but one life to risk. I see his suffering, the wounds in his flesh and the hurt in his limbs, but more than that, the pain in his heart. Like Rogel, he has given everything, and it has not been enough. He has destroyed Angron, broken Karbanda, closed the Eternity Gate, and locked the final fortress. And yet, the walls fall. The sun is red, the clocks run out. He does not understand why we are made to suffer. None of them do, in truth. Not even the Primarch's sons have the context to understand the scope of their father's plan, the depth of his allotheistic learning, or the true extent of what is at stake. But Sanguinius, bright angel, he feels it most of all. I taste his anguish. There will be no recrimination. He simply wants to ask his father, why? In different ways, they both seek revelation. They are coming to us. I do not need to summon them. They are coming to ask for help, and this time, perhaps to their surprise, my master will be ready to answer them. Who else? My mind unfurls, spreads wider, out into the body of the sanctum precinct, where towers burn and walls that should have held forever subside in torrents like a child's toy blocks. The Palatine is entirely invaded, with homicidal urgency and fetishistic glee. The air reeks of ozone and smoke filth. Trumpets and sirens blast alarums that are too late, or blare orders that cannot be followed. This was mankind's central arcology, the heart of empire, and it is overrun by a chronicle slaughter and waves of never-born carnage. Only the final fortress, sealed by Sanguinius's monumental deed, remains sacrosanct. Those of our forces that got inside before the great gate closed now man the last walls, and those that did not, so very, very many, will now never get in, and are doomed to fight to the death in the insanity of the Palatine Zone. Even the final fortress has been contaminated. Before the Archangel locked the gate, the first invaders broke through. Now the gate is shut, and the sentinels of the Legio Custodes labor to exterminate any traces of the enemy that slipped inside. The demons are here. There, Valdor, first of the 10,000, defender of the inner circle. He is hunting in the preceptory of the Hieronymite, eradicating the squealing horrors that stole in before eternity closed. Constantine's mind is bright with focus. The master of the Legio Custodes is a dreadful thing, perhaps the most ruthless of all the demigods my lord commands. To Constantine was granted very little latitude. His role is the simplest of all. He has fulfilled it without hesitation. He stands apart from the others, not a son, but both less and more. An ever-vigilant proxy, impartial and unwavering, not biased by issues of blood, lineage, or fraternity. He was made to stand apart, so there would be one among them who could keep the unprejudiced objectivity of distance. But in the course of this war, my lord has come to pity him, and has allowed Constantine to learn more and share more of his noesis. In part, he did this because it would help Valdor perform his duties even better, but he also judged it only fair to let him learn. He gave Valdor a weapon, the Apollonian spear, and through it, revelation. With each kill it makes, it teaches him. Each thrust through demonic flesh and bone imparts instruction, feeding Constantine knowledge from the things he kills. I only hope he has not learned too much. I fear he might have seen enough to interrogate his creator's design. I know Constantine is acting on his own recognizance now, building contingencies of his own in case my lord's plan fails. He thinks he is keeping this secret from me, but he is not. I know he has permitted the construction of a weapon to be used in extremis. It will end my lord's sons, and their sons too, all of them, without discrimination. Constantine has always questioned the wisdom of the demigods his master made. I have allowed him the consolation of this weapon, accepting even the employment of the genius monster he recruited to make it. It will not be needed. Or, if it is, then it exists, and our master will not be alive to witness its use. I call to him.
My king,
he says, hearing my voice as his lord's. He comes at once without demur, leaving his men to finish the work, leaving neverborn things writhing and lacerated in his wake, his damascened armor splashed with their blood. He is still, without doubt, loyal. He will hold his secret weapon in reserve and stand at his master's side as the clocks run out. Only after that, if his master is gone, will he enact his sanction, draw the curtain down on this bloody revenger's tragedy, and wipe it all away. Valdor is on his way. Rogel and Sanguinius. Vulcan. My mind drifts for a moment, through the fused ceramite ruins of the inner palace, vainly searching through streets filmed with bacterial clouds and caustic gas, and the wind-blown ashes of a million victims. There should be others to find. Once there were so many, who could be called upon in an hour of need. But there are no more. These four are the last of them. The rest are all dead, or have become the reason that our world is dying.